and time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This station, in cooperation with the Atomic Energy Commission's Argonne National Laboratory, presents Atomic Year 25, a silver anniversary documentary on the birth of the atomic era. Producer for this radio special is Ed Ronnie of Argonne's information staff. Mr. Ronnie.
An event that changed the course of man's life occurred on December 2nd, 1942, at the University of Chicago's Stagg Field. Scientists achieved a nuclear chain reaction. Matter had been changed into energy in a dramatic transformation. No other event has revolutionized both war and peace in such an impressive way. The atom, a potential as we know for war, but also for man's good, for use in exploring space, combating diseases, and providing power for home and industry. Here then is the story of the world's best-kept wartime secret, as we look back on it from Atomic Year 25. The atomic age was not born overnight. There was talk of nuclear power in the early 30s. Dr. Emilio Segre, now at the University of California at Berkeley, experimented with radiation in those early days in Italy.
This feeling that one had to quit atomic physics and go on to the nucleus was much stronger, and we started to do something about it. And this was in the years 1931, 32, 33. Well, remember that in 32, then there were the great discoveries, neutron, heavy hydrogen, deuterium, the positron. I mean, it was very clear that our feelings were correct, namely that the nucleus was going to become the great thing.
Niels Bohr, a brilliant Danish physicist, arrived in the United States in January 1939. He was deeply concerned about the implications of a recent experiment by Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin. Bohr's colleagues, Lisa Meitner and Otto Frisch, had told him of this experiment before he left Europe. Hahn and Strassmann had produced fission. Neutrons had entered a nucleus, split the atom, and released energy. Bohr met Albert Einstein at Princeton, New Jersey, and told him about the discovery. From there, the news reached men like Dr. Enrico Fermi and Dr. Herbert Anderson at Columbia University. Dr. Fermi, an Italian-born Nobel Prize winner, had come to this country about the same time as Bohr. Dr. Anderson was a member of Fermi's team at Columbia. He now is at the University of Chicago. He tells of a meeting of scientists towards the end of January of 39.
Very shortly after my initial meeting with Bohr and then Fermi, there was a meeting scheduled in Washington in theoretical physics. And with Bohr's news, the interest and attention of the meeting immediately focused on the new development. And the meeting heard speeches by Bohr and then by Fermi, who outlined what they understood about the process and its significance. Of course, this sent various scientists running to the laboratory to confirm the result and excited the news reporters very much when they began to sense the wide implications that this new development might have for the world.
In February 1940, the first government funds were set aside for investigating the possibilities of making an atomic bomb. secret experiments got underway at many university campuses. At the University of California, in December 1940, a group of chemists discovered a new element, its given name, plutonium. Dr. Glenn Seaborg, now chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, was a co-discoverer of this element.
Well, the significance of plutonium for the war effort was, of course, its use as the explosive ingredient in the nuclear weapon. Plutonium also, of course, has a tremendous potential for peaceful uses. It is the fissionable isotope that is produced from the abundant uranium isotope, uranium-238.
November 1941. Scientists concerned with the project concluded that, in theory, a pile of graphite and uranium could be assembled so as to support a chain reaction. And in this process, a portion of the uranium would be converted to fissionable plutonium, and that the plutonium, in turn, could be used in a weapon. The late Dr. Arthur Compton, a much-respected physicist at the University of Chicago, was to become the director of the pile project. He later became president of Washington University in St. Louis. In a recording made 15 years ago, Dr. Compton comments on a high-level meeting in Washington on December 6, 1941.
We discussed the enormous difficulties involved in making an atomic chain reaction, which was as yet only an idea on paper, of learning the chemistry of plutonium, and of developing a method for separating it from the other substances in the presence of the lethal radiation of tremendous intensity. We agreed that, though it was difficult, it wasn't impossible. Thus, as an afterthought, I was commissioned to bring together the physicists who would endeavor to set up the chain reaction, and the chemists who would look for a method of extracting the plutonium after it was produced. That was on Saturday. Sunday, the following day, I learned of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The nation was alert. Our project became more vital to us than life or death. From all parts of the country, men competent in the field rallied to give what help they could. The University of Chicago campus was made the center of the effort to produce plutonium.
Dr. Norman Hilberry, today at the University of Arizona, was made associate director of the project. He knew he had a job to do, and the problems were enormous.
It was fairly clear that the real problem in establishing a chain reaction was the absorption of the neutrons produced in fission, the absorption by impurities. It was nip and tuck as to whether or not one would be able to get a chain reaction with just normal uranium and any sort of a moderator that we could lay our hands on. Consequently, we took a hard look at what the purity of our materials were, and the impurities present were just spectacular in their nature. They could swallow up neutrons like nobody's business. Now, there were two areas in which we simply had to get rid of these impurities. One of these was in the uranium. Now, that was half of it. The other half was the graphite in which you embedded this uranium also had to be pure because the neutrons went wandering around all through it. That was what it was there for. And if there were impurities in it, then you were in trouble.
Dr. Leona Libby, now at the University of Colorado, was the only woman scientist on the project.
Now, Wally Sim wouldn't let me work at the squash court because, you see, everybody wore overalls and goggles and a mask against the dust, so everyone looked alike, and a miner's cap, you know, a regular striped blue ticking workman's cap. So everyone looked alike, and he said in case he had to say nasty words to somebody, he didn't want it to be a girl. So I was excluded from the actual construction, although I was in and out every day with calibrations and measuring the growing neutron flux of the reactor as it added layer by layer.
Dr. Seaborg and several of his colleagues moved their laboratory to Chicago in the spring of 1942.
Actually, I came to Chicago at that time with Dr. Isidore Perlman, and I left Berkeley on April 17, 1942, on the City of San Francisco Streamliner, and arrived in Chicago on the morning of April 19th, which happened to be my 30th birthday.
The scientists came, men like Eugene Wigner, Frank Spedding, Samuel Allison, Leo Szilard, Walter Zinn, and many others, a select group working hand in hand on one of the nation's most urgent projects. And in those hands, the unknown power of the atom, soon to be unleashed. June 1942. A once top-secret letter stated, "Laboratory evidence is convincing that a suitable structure of pure uranium and graphite should result in a chain reaction which would become self-sustaining if enough material were used." August 1942. Dr. Seaborg and his team of chemists were able to see plutonium for the first time. It had been produced in a cyclotron.
We first saw, and this represents the work of Burris B. Cunningham and Lewis Werner, plutonium in the pure state on August 18th, and it was first weighed in pure form on an ultra-micro balance on September 10th.
Also in August of 1942, the U.S. Army engineers were now taking charge of the bomb work, and the entire venture was given the code name Manhattan Project. Leslie R. Groves was promoted to a brigadier general and placed in charge. He describes the circumstances at Chicago at that time.
It was essentially the transition period between the college laboratory type of work and industrial research. And it was just in that in-between stage, and it was in that stage when I first saw the Chicago affair.
After building up, testing, and tearing down more than 30 different piles, in late November 1942, the final configuration of materials was beginning to take shape. Crews worked around the clock to piece together 385 tons of pure graphite, 40 tons of uranium oxide, and 6 tons of uranium metal. It was decided that an airtight cover should be available for the pile. Dr. Anderson sent an unusual order to the Goodyear Company. "We need a huge square balloon."
Well, needless to say, a square balloon was something unheard of by the Goodyear Company. They'd made balloons in all kinds of shapes, but always round. But there was a war going on by this time, and they were beginning to get used to strange requests. Although they were very much mystified, they quite willingly cooperated and turned out to be very helpful and produced a very good square balloon.
Early December would be the time for verifying all the painstaking calculations, and hopefully, we were ahead of the Nazis. On the morning of December 2nd, it appeared to some scientists on the plutonium production work that the project might be on shaky ground. A reviewing committee of leading engineers met with Dr. Compton in Chicago. They were looking into a number of ways to make fissionable materials. The committee had been charged with recommending to the government how to proceed with the atomic bomb project. 2 weeks earlier, they had concluded that 500,000 man-years of effort would be required, and they felt that it might well prove to be an impossible task. On recording, the late Dr. Compton recalls that meeting.
"The reviewing committee met me in the conference room. 'Where's Fermi?' they asked me. Enrico Fermi, 8 years before, working in his laboratory at Rome with the help of a single assistant, had shown how to handle the neutrons that play the vital role in the nuclear reaction. He was now directing the construction of our experimental atomic reactor. "I'm sorry," I replied, "but Fermi has asked to be excused. He's busy in the laboratory this morning. Perhaps I can answer your questions." And so we discussed back and forth for several hours. The telephone rang. It was word from the research team. "We're ready to try the critical experiment." I chose the youngest member of this reviewing committee because I thought he would have a longer time to remember what he had seen. And so I took with me Crawford Greenewald of the DuPont Company, and we walked over to the laboratory. We entered the balcony at one end of the room. On the balcony, a dozen scientists were watching the instruments and handling the controls. Across the room was a large cubical pile of graphite and uranium blocks in which we hoped the atomic chain reaction would develop. Inserted into openings in this pile of blocks were control and safety rods. After a few preliminary tests, Fermi gave the order to withdraw the control rod another foot. We knew that that was going to be the real test. The Geiger counters registering the neutrons from the reactor began to click faster and faster till their sound became a rattle. "Throw in the safety rods," came Fermi's order. And you could see the pointer move right back to zero. The rattle of the counters fell to a slow series of clicks. For the first time, atomic power had been released. It had been controlled and stopped.
That was Dr. Compton. Crawford Greenwalt, now chairman of the board of the DuPont Company, comments on his reaction on that day.
"Well, the scene wasn't very exciting, actually. People were very calm. I think there was a general confidence in Fermi and a general confidence in the fact that the pile would go critical as planned. And so there was no gnashing of teeth or tearing of hair or anything of that sort. It was very calm."
Among the others who were present on that cold December afternoon, 3:25 p.m. to be exact, was Dr. Walter Zinn, today a vice president of combustion engineering.
"Well, for people who were deeply involved in it, it had to be a little bit of an anticlimax. And the reason for saying that is that what happened on December 2nd was not, so to speak, a sudden surprise to anybody who was involved in it. Because as we built this structure, we made measurements continuously which told us that we were approaching the chain reaction situation."
Dr. Compton topped off the activities of the day by phoning Dr. James Conant. Dr. Conant was the chairman of the National Defense Research Committee. Dr. Compton, again on recording, tells about that closely guarded telephone message.
"As the reviewing committee left, I picked up the phone and called Dr. Conant at Cambridge. He knew of the critical experiment on which we were engaged, but he hadn't expected results quite so soon. We talked in, as usual, in an extemporaneous wartime code. "The Italian navigator has just landed in the New World," I told him. "The Earth was not as big as he had supposed. What I had in mind was that the uranium and graphite pile didn't have to be made as big as had been anticipated. So he arrived a few days earlier than he had expected. Were the natives friendly?" was Conant's response. "Everyone landed safe and happy." Such was the birth of atomic power.
Confirmation of the chain reaction studies with the CP1, Chicago Pile No. 1, was an inspiration and reassurance to scientists on the project. General Groves, viewing the plutonium work from a military standpoint, provided this objective statement.
"I wasn't particularly elated because I felt that it was just one of the steps that had to be overcome. My job was very definite, been assigned by Secretary Stimson, which was a very definite mission, was to bring the war to an end sooner than it would otherwise end, and thus save American lives by the development of atomic energy. And each step was like one rung up the ladder, and there was an awfully long ladder."
Dr. Seaborg continued his research with plutonium.
Actually, the process for the production of the plutonium, as it involved the chemical extraction process, was not even conceived until after the success of CP1. We immediately then went forward at as fast a pace as possible to develop this chemical extraction process.
Someone had calculated that it would have taken 70,000 years for the CP1 pile to produce enough plutonium for one bomb. Without a doubt, it was necessary now to proceed with full-scale production plants. The Chicago story, told here only fleetingly, was only a part of the overall Manhattan Project. As General Groves stated, it was one rung up a long ladder. There were more than 70 research groups under Dr. Compton scattered around the country. Even before the Chicago pile succeeded, a large atomic pile was being planned for Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and the design for those at Hanford, Washington, followed swiftly on the heels of this event. The mammoth plants at Oak Ridge and Hanford were to supply the raw materials, like uranium-235 and plutonium, for the weapons work at Los Alamos, New Mexico. At sunrise on July 16, 1945, the sleeping desert near Alamogordo, New Mexico, was illuminated by the light of 1,000 suns, and the sound of the atom torn asunder reminded one of doomsday. It was the first test of a nuclear explosion. Dr. Segrais was right in his prediction of 1932. The nucleus was to become a great thing. Japan surrendered, peace had come, and with the new era, a new tool, as important for its peaceful uses as for defense.
What really has happened has been that by adding to our raw materials certain quantities of artificially radioactive materials, we are now in the position in which we can make inanimate objects communicate intelligently with other inanimate objects. For example, we can make a piece of paper tell the machine that is making it whether it's doing it right or not, and if it isn't doing it right, tell the machine how to correct what it's doing so that it will be right. Now, this is just one example. There are just loads of others.
The whole Mojave Desert could be turned into a garden using a desalinization plant run by nuclear energy. And it would set an example for the whole world.
The development of atomic energy as a source of power has opened up a replacement which is exceedingly abundant, much more abundant than fossil fuels ever were, so that mankind will have the energy to do his tasks for many years, perhaps many hundreds of years more than if atomic energy had not been discovered.
President Lyndon B. Johnson, speaking on atomic energy, said this about the future of the atom.
This energy is to propel the machines of progress, to light our cities and our towns, to fire our factories, to provide new sources of fresh water, and to really help us solve the mysteries of outer space as it brightens our life on this planet. We have moved far to tame for peaceful uses the mighty forces unloosed when this atom was split, and we have only just begun.
This station, in cooperation with the Atomic Energy Commission's Argonne National Laboratory, has presented Atomic Year 25. Producer and narrator has been Ed Ronnie of Argonne's information staff. This has been a special broadcast commemorating the 25th anniversary of the successful achievement of a controlled nuclear chain reaction at the University of Chicago on December 2nd, 1942. Let's talk about the atom. The United States Atomic Energy Commission, in cooperation with this station, joins in bringing you a special series of programs on the uses of atomic energy. From east coast to west, and from north to south, men of science are searching for and finding new ways of applying the tiny atom. Your producer and host for this series is Ed Ronnie of the information staff at the AEC's Argonne National Laboratory. And now, let's talk about the atom. Mr. Ronnie.
The radio you're listening to right now may be operating on atomic power. More than likely, you are not aware of it. Atomic power, working quietly but diligently behind the scenes, is becoming more important in our daily lives with each passing year. At the time of this recording, the United States has more than 100 atomic power stations, either operating, under construction, or on the drawing boards. And we are not alone in the development of atomic power to produce electricity for our homes and industries. It's being widely used in Canada, England, Russia, France, and in many other nations. The production of power from the atom was a dream of many of the scientists who helped usher in the atomic age more than 25 years ago. Since then, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, in cooperation with industry, has worked long and hard to make the new energy source more efficient and more economical. Today, as we talk about the atom, we will hear from Milton Shaw, Director of the Atomic Energy Commission's Division of Reactor Development and Technology. We are in his office at AEC headquarters in Washington, D.C. Well, Mr. Shaw, atomic power comes from atomic reactors. First of all, what is a reactor?
A nuclear reactor releases the energy stored in the nucleus of a uranium atom and in a controlled fashion releases it in the form of heat. In this process, as predicted by Dr. Albert Einstein, energy is released since the mass is decreased. There is an exchange of mass for energy in this process.
Well, then, what is the main difference between atomic power and ordinary power produced by coal and gas?
The electricity generated is the same. The most important difference between atomic power and the power produced by coal, gas, or oil is the essentially complete absence of pollution. All burned-up uranium fuel and the products of that burning are contained in the reactor. Another important difference is that the burning of 1 pound of uranium produces as much energy as 3 million pounds of coal. Just think of the ease of transportation, the absence of coal piles and ash heaps, and the absence of smokestacks.
Why are we developing atomic power plants?
I think it's a well-recognized fact that electric power is vital to the health, comfort, and economic well-being of the American people. Although some might consider it just a convenience, power is essential to our modern society. Electric power is used to heat and cool our homes, to provide lighting, to run our industries, and to assist us in performing a multitude of other tasks. Moreover, the electric power requirements in this country have been doubling every 10 years. Future expansion is expected to continue in much the same pattern, and steam electric power plants, whether fossil or nuclear-fired, must be relied upon in the main to meet these ever-increasing power demands.
Well, could you tell us at this point in time how much power is being produced from the atom in the United States?
As an example, in late 69, a typical month would show that 13 nuclear power plants generated about 1.5 billion kilowatt hours. If one recognizes that the average home in the United States uses about 500 kilowatt hours per month, the nuclear generation in a typical month would supply about 3 million homes in this country. But this is really only a fraction of the United States electricity production. But from the low percentage of today, we will, in a generation, see 50% or more of our electricity generated from clean, non-polluting nuclear power plants.
Mr. Shaw, with more and more atomic power plants going into operation, will our electric bills go down?
The competition of nuclear power has been a very large factor in maintaining the electric bills at low levels, as you could readily notice by comparing your electrical bill, that is this month or next, that is the cost per kilowatt hour today compared with the cost per kilowatt hour of 1965. It really is an interesting exercise for the public to do this and compare the results of the price of electricity with the price of food, the cost of their home, of cars, of gasoline, or clothing, in a sense of today's costs compared with 1965, and I think from this it will be readily apparent that the relative price of electricity is going down and will continue to go down in the future.
And we ought to hasten to add that the government is not doing all the work on reactor development. Utilities and other people are doing an awful lot of work, aren't they?
Absolutely, and I think sometimes, in fact, too frequently, one neglects the large-scale commitments the industry and the utilities have made in this country to date. At this time, we have 5 major reactor manufacturers devoting their resources to the development of the liquid metal fast breeder. In addition, another major reactor manufacturer is devoting his efforts to the development of the fast gas breeder. Over 100 utilities are also contributing to this effort today in this country.
Would you comment briefly on the safety record of nuclear plants?
From its inception, the concern over the health and safety of the public has been a very instrumental part of our reactor development program, and of course it's well known that it must be an essential determination in every nuclear power plant application. The safety record in nuclear power has been outstanding in this country, but we are determined that more work should be done in a continual manner in order to make sure it stays this way with the broader scale application of nuclear power.
Would you comment on the future of atomic power, perhaps its use in converting seawater to freshwater?
The large breeder reactor systems that will eventually bring the cost of electricity down will also permit us to extract, use, and reuse a number of other natural resources in this country in a most advantageous manner. For example, it will permit us to take seawater and convert the seawater to freshwater. And in the same sense that one projects the large-scale demands for electricity into the future, one can also project the large-scale demands for fresh water. And we believe that cheap and abundant energy developed from the atom will be instrumental in providing not only the electrical power demands for the future, but also converting seawater to fresh water.
Well, thank you very much, Milton Shaw, Director of the Division of Reactor Development and Technology, the Atomic Energy Commission. We have been in his office at AEC headquarters in Washington. Next time around, a further look at what atomic energy can do for our benefit.
The United States Atomic Energy Commission and this station have brought you in touch with modern-day uses of atomic energy. Listen again as we talk about the atom and its application to our lives. Your producer and host has been Ed Ronnie of the information staff at the AEC's Argonne National Laboratory.
Thank you. Question: is there an energy-making machine that produces more fuel than it burns? Answer: the Breeder Reactor. President Nixon has called it the nation's highest priority energy program. Breeding a new fuel for power is the topic of today's report in the documentary series Let's Talk About Energy, presented by the United States Atomic Energy Commission. This is your field reporter, John Flynn. Everyone talks about the energy crisis. Problem is, the fuels we burn to make energy, to light and heat our homes, to run our automobiles, to power our industries, these fuels have begun to dwindle at a time when our need for energy is growing rapidly. What's more, we expect demands for electrical power will double every 10 years for the next 30 years. In that same period, our supplies of readily available oil and natural gas will diminish to a barely noticeable trickle. As these conventional energy resources dwindle, we will rely more and more on electrical power produced by nuclear reactors, plants that use uranium as fuel rather than coal, oil, or natural gas. To make things even more difficult, the atomic fuel used in most commercial nuclear power stations, uranium-235, will not always be as cheaply available as it is today. Still, the prospects for nuclear power are far from bleak. The United States Atomic Energy Commission and our utilities are optimistic about a new type of nuclear reactor that produces more fuel than it burns. It's called the Breeder Reactor.
It is called a breeder reactor because in the process of generating heat by fissioning uranium or plutonium, the machine generates more fuel than it consumes. And it does this by transforming the abundant isotope of uranium found in nature, uranium-238, into plutonium, and the plutonium then in turn can be used as a fissionable material.
Thomas A. Nemczyk, Director of the Division of Reactor Research and Development of the United States Atomic Energy Commission. The machine Mr. Nemczyk refers to, the breeder reactor, converts a so-called fertile form of uranium into a fissionable fuel, a fuel that will release enormous amounts of energy when its atoms are split and a controlled chain reaction is sustained. The most common fissionable form of uranium is an isotope known as uranium-235. The fertile form of uranium is natural uranium, uranium-238. Its atoms do not fission or split apart to any great extent, and it cannot be used as fuel in present nuclear power plants. It can be used, however, in a breeder reactor. Uranium-238 is readily available in quantity in nature. Supplies of uranium-235, the fissionable fuel, are very limited by comparison.
Normally, with uranium as it comes out of the ground, we have to mine well over 100 pounds of uranium in order to extract from it the fissionable isotope currently used in the nuclear power plants that are being built around the country. Uranium-238, which comprises more than 99% of the uranium coming from the ground, and uranium-235, which is less than 1%. The uranium-235 is the fissionable isotope of uranium and is used as the fuel in today's light water reactor power plants. Early in the history of atomic energy, the pioneers, you might say, discovered that when uranium-238, although not fissionable and therefore not capable of generating heat in today's power plants, when it captured a neutron, it was transformed into plutonium-239, which was fissionable. Those scientists in the middle 1940s designed an experimental power plant which was capable of generating more fissionable material than it used. And with the supply of uranium that we have on hand, that gives us what amounts to an inexhaustible energy supply for centuries to come.
In an operating breeder reactor, uranium-235 or some other fissionable material starts the chain reaction. The chain reaction generates high-velocity neutrons, neutrons that travel at speeds of 30 or 40,000 miles per hour. Large quantities of fertile uranium-238 will be made to capture these high-speed neutrons. And when this happens, uranium-238 becomes a new element, plutonium, a rich man-made nuclear fuel. And so the breeder truly produces more nuclear fuel in the form of plutonium than the small amount of fissionable fuel required to start and sustain the energy-producing chain reaction. The plutonium can then be used to refuel the same reactor and to fuel other reactors. to make steam to power the turbines that make electricity. This is not entirely a new concept. Experimental breeder reactors are currently operating in the United States and elsewhere.
The first breeder reactor was a liquid metal cooled breeder. It was built at the National Reactor Testing Station in Idaho and actually produced the first electricity. A light bulb was lighted by the electricity generated in 1951. Another experimental breeder reactor plant was constructed. It was a plant that generates about 20 megawatts of electricity and is used as an experimental facility in which to test materials, fuels materials, and components in a liquid metal system. We also have under construction a large test facility near Richland, Washington, on our Hanford reservation called the Fast Flux Test Facility. We have just initiated arrangements under which we will construct a 400 megawatt electric fast breeder demonstration plant.
That new demonstration plant should put us on the road toward providing adequate fuel and energy to fill the needs of generations to come. Our nation is not alone in its belief that the breeder reactor is an important option for the future, says Mr. Nemzik. Breeders of various sizes have also been built in England, France, and Russia.
The European endeavors in this regard are somewhat ahead of the United States. Recently, the French put their demonstration plant on the line. Our demonstration plant is not scheduled to go on the line until 1980 or thereabouts. So that we really are in a position somewhat behind, but we are going about our development effort in a very deliberate, very high-quality way so that we can be sure that when we put our plant on the line, that it will operate properly in every respect and live up to all of our expectations.
One major reason that many countries, ours as well, look favorably at the breeder is its lack of adverse environmental effects. It would need no smokestacks. Heat discharged into nearby bodies of water by the breeder is no more and perhaps less than the waste heat discharged by a coal-burning plant. Fish and other life in those water bodies should experience no effects beyond the effects experienced by aquatic life in the vicinity of any conventional power plant. In addition, Mr. Nemzik believes that breeder reactors can be built and operated as safely as any other nuclear power plant. If we review the extraordinary safety record of the nuclear power industry over the past quarter century, that should be quite safe. Finally, in view of the energy crisis we face today, Mr. Nemzik talked about how the breeder can help to meet our increasing energy needs and still meet environmental and safety considerations as well.
We would expect that just beyond the mid-1980s, the breeder reactors will become acceptable as a conventional nuclear power source for the utility industry. So that by the end of the 80s, we will be building a few of these plants per year, and by the year 2000, we can look forward to having several hundred liquid metal fast breeder reactor plants producing power around the country. From an environmental standpoint, we have no normal industrial pollutants. We have no radioactive pollutants escaping from the plant. They are contained in the plant, so that when we look at a liquid metal fast breeder plant in total and looking forward to it being on the line in the future, we see an extremely clean plant. First, rejecting a minimum amount of heat to the environment, and second, virtually no other products escaping from the plant that would be considered to be have an adverse impact on the environment. That's the way the plant is designed, and that's the way the plant will operate.
Today, another report in the documentary series, Let's Talk About Energy, brought to you by the United States Atomic Energy Commission. Our guest has been Mr. Thomas A. Nemzik, Director of the Division of Reactor Research and Development of the Atomic Energy Commission. This is your field reporter, John Flynn.
This is Energy and the Atom. From the world headquarters of the American Nuclear Society in Hinsdale, Illinois, we bring you a special series devoted to energy and the atom. Since the birth of the atomic age, the world has found countless ways to make use of this new energy source. This series, produced and moderated by Ed Ronnie, is brought to you as a public service by the American Nuclear Society and this station. Mr. Ronnie.
The late Enrico Fermi, the Italian navigator of the New World who led a team of scientists into the atomic age, once stated the following: the country which first develops a breeder reactor will have a great competitive advantage in atomic energy. Even during those early days under the West Stands at the University of Chicago, Dr. Fermi had the vision of breeder reactors for the production of electricity. We find ourselves talking today with Mr. Wallace Behnke, Executive Vice President of Commonwealth Edison in Chicago, and Chairman of the Board of the Project Management Corporation. Well, Mr. Behnke, first of all, what do we mean by a breeder?
A breeder is an advanced form of nuclear reactor, which when used to produce electricity will utilize uranium about 30 times more efficiently than do today's nuclear power plants.
Was Dr. Fermi correct in his observations about the breeder reactor?
Yes, I believe Dr. Fermi was entirely correct in his observations about the breeder. The breeder reactors are going to play a vital part in the utilization of atomic energy throughout the world, and the nation that first develops a breeder will be in a strong competitive position to provide the technology for the world energy economy.
Mr. Behnke, we mentioned the Project Management Corporation in our introduction, and we said that you are chairman of the board. Now, what is the Project Management Corporation?
The Project Management Corporation is a nonprofit corporation that was put together under the auspices of the electric power industry in the United States and the Atomic Energy Commission for the purpose of managing the construction and demonstration operation of the nation's first large-scale breeder demonstration plant.
Why do we have to develop the breeder reactor with all its added problems and high costs? Aren't the power plants we now have good enough?
Well, in our nation today, about 80% of our energy consumption is the form of oil and gas, and yet these two fuels constitute only about 6% of our nation's energy reserves. On the other hand, there is enough coal and uranium contained in domestic reserves to provide energy for this country sufficient to last for 1,000 years. The importance of the breeder is that with the breeder, we will be able to use our domestic uranium reserves for hundreds of years, while without the breeder, most of our high-grade uranium reserves will be all used up by the end of this century.
How much money will it take to develop a full-scale working plant?
Estimates today are that it will cost about $1.2 billion to build the Clinch River breeder reactor demonstration plant. Another $500 million will be required for supporting research and development, fuel for the plant, and additional costs during the five-year demonstration operation period. While these costs may seem high in relation to what regular power plants cost, it's important to recognize that this is a first-of-a-kind plant. The economy for these breeder plants will come down with the scale-up in size and the improved technology that will attend the larger plants of the future. And in our judgment, there's a good chance that breeder reactor plants can be built so they will produce power competitively with other forms of electric generation.
And, of course, a logical question is, who will pay for it?
Well, the Clinch River breeder reactor plant is being jointly funded by the electric power industry in this country and the federal government. As things stand now, the electric light and power industry in the United States is supplying about $254 million of the project cost, and the balance will be supplied from federal funds.
The plant will be built near Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Why was that site selected for this plant?
The site was selected for Oak Ridge, Tennessee, because in the judgment of those of us who are responsible for manning the project, this was the best site. It was important to find a site that was located on one of the nation's large electric power systems. And in view of the Tennessee Valley Authority's participation in this project, it seemed perfectly logical to locate the plant on a site they own in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The site is ideally suited for the breeder in terms of its topography, in terms of its environmental advantages, and this is why we chose the Clinch River site.
Some of the critics of breeder reactors especially, they're concerned about this. Now, it's going to introduce a lot of problems, they say, and we really don't need it. We ought to go into solar energy. What do you say to them?
Well, as a matter as important to this nation as energy supply, it's absolutely essential that we have a high-confidence strategy to assure the long-range supply of viable clean energy at reasonable cost. As things stand today, the fast breeder is the only advanced technology that does not rely on fossil fuels that has any chance of all of being commercially viable in this century. It seems, therefore, that absolutely essential that we go forward with the breeder in order to preserve the option to have nuclear power part of our energy economy. And while these other technologies may come along, and indeed they should be pursued, it is too risky, it is too great a risk for us to rely solely on them for our energy supplies of the future.
Now, what is the time schedule right now for operation of the plant?
Current estimates are that we can have the plant online as early as 1982. This schedule provides, however, that early site work must begin this year, and construction, major construction, must get underway in 1976.
What if we can't get the plant built? Some have said this project might turn out to be something like the SST airplane.
Well, on a matter as important as energy supply, it's absolutely essential that this country have a high-confidence strategy for meeting its future energy needs. If we are not allowed to go ahead with the Clinch River program, of course, we'll have to fall back to some other answers. We could reconstitute the program later on and face the higher cost to this nation in terms of future energy costs and, in fact, in carrying out the program itself. We could risk greater dependence on foreign breeder technologies because the breeder is going to be developed in the world whether or not the United States goes ahead. We could face the environmental and cost consequences of greater dependence on coal. And of course, we could place greater reliance on the hope that some of the more advanced technologies, such as fusion and solar power, might be developed in time to save a major shortage in energy supply in this country. But all things considered, the risk on the reliance on these alternate strategies, and it is too great a risk, is, in our judgment, one that we should not take.
One of the leaders of this giant undertaking has been our guest today, Mr. Wallace Behnke, Executive Vice President of the Commonwealth Edison Company of Chicago and Chairman of the Board of the Project Management Corporation, Breeder Reactors, where we now stand and where we're going. Today's feature on energy and the atom.
This station and the American Nuclear Society have presented an informal discussion of atomic energy and its uses in our world today. Ed Ronnie has been your producer and host for Energy and the Atom.
To all my listeners, I hope the program you have just heard has made your day just that little bit better. I look forward to reading your cards and letters over the air. Send them to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. If you wish to tip the storyteller and are not comfortable mailing wads of cash, you can go to paypal.me/PrometheusLives. Every little bit is greatly appreciated.
A recurring gift of support at patreon.com/publius_reads will be acknowledged with benefits such as individual downloadable chapters. You might also want to give my other Anon radio show a listen. A Step Farther Out. 19 UTC, Saturdays. Until next time, this has been...
Hear Now the Words.
Johnny, I just ended a very odd phone call. It was Sarah. She said, I've just run into somebody who keeps saying she has to talk to John and Rosalie. This woman says John and Rosalie will help me.
Well, how does this woman say has been talking about know us?
Well, that's the strange part, honey. I've never heard of her.
Well, I'm curious. Ask Sarah to send her over. You know, I've just made a decision for Christ, so now I've got the inside track.
What are you talking about?
Well, for years I've been waiting for the UFO occupants to contact me. I think they've just been waiting for me to plug in. You see, Christ is the magic word.